And welcome back to the Eye on College Football podcast here on CBSSports.com. I am Chip Patterson, joined by Tom Fornelli. Hi, Tom.
Hey!
And we are so happy to be rewinding week one, at least 3 days of action. We are sitting here recording this on Sunday afternoon. So if Baylor, SMU, Utah State, Tennessee, or if you're listening to this on Tuesday and Miami and Louisville have completely taken over the college football world with whatever happened, I'm sorry. It's just a little bit dated. But we have a ton of action to review. It started Thursday night. It went all the way through a Washington-Hawaii game that I really wish I could have back. But we'll be hitting all of that. And I will say, Tom, just in general, it is sort of our nature to wake up on Sunday and try and figure out what the story of yesterday was. And I hear a lot of people that are coming out and saying, this shows us that we really don't know anything about college football. Well, I don't know about you, but I knew that I didn't know anything about college football. It's one of the reasons I'm so excited to watch, is because some crazy stuff that you didn't predict could happen all the time. And no matter how many returning starters you think you understand and trends and different previous performances, there's going to be some stuff that happens. That's just football. For me, I walk away from yesterday and Thursday, Friday, Saturday thinking there's really not anybody in the entire country that looks unbeatable right now. What was sort of, and I think that's awesome. I think that's a very good and exciting thing. What sort of stood out to you so far from these first 3 days of the season?
Everybody is overrated and every conference sucks.
Yeah, exactly. Doesn't yesterday really prove that the SEC is overrated?
Yeah, I mean, when Vanderbilt lost to Temple, I'm pretty sure that was the end of the conference.
That was the end of the
domination
conference
right there. It started with Florida State beating Auburn in the national title game. You know, it was like the Leaning Tower of Pisa after that one. But then Temple came along and just pushed that tower right the hell over in Nashville.
But unfortunately, there's going to be a lot of sports radio interviews where I feel like that question's going to come. Doesn't this weekend show that blank? And I feel like the confirmation bias will allow you to basically fill in those two blanks with any team or conference. What in general?
Oh, had Wisconsin beaten LSU last night, I guarantee you there'd be is the SEC done talk going on right now.
Is the rain truly done?
Yeah, is the SEC done? Is it on its way down? Will all the coaches start leaving for other schools?
No.
Will Feinbaum have to find a new job?
No. Hey, sneak peek on that one. No. Well, let's start at Florida State. Florida State, Oklahoma State. The Florida State looks very, very out of character. If you tuned into the game expecting to see the Seminoles team that absolutely destroyed most of their schedule last season on the way to winning that national title, Jameis Winston throws two interceptions. Oklahoma State showed up. That's probably my biggest takeaway from this game, is that I was really ready to sell Oklahoma State. And I understand that, you know, they still need to show this on a week in, week out basis. And last season, even, there was a lot of inconsistency. There was that weird West Virginia game. I think that this Oklahoma State team, you know, I'm not a huge J.W. Walsh fan, but he came out and balled. The defense, which we didn't know a lot of those names, they came out and played. What was sort of your takeaway from this game, a much closer Florida State win than I think many of us expected?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not as surprised about Oklahoma State as you are. I'm surprised that they played as well as they did in this game, because my opinion of Oklahoma State coming into this season was it was going to be a team that was much better in November than it was going to be, you know, this weekend against Florida State, because there is so much youth on that defense. I didn't think that they'd just be able to come in against a team like Florida State and do as good of a job as they did slowing them down, which, I mean, Florida State, it was somewhat off. You know, they seemed off for that night, but at the end of the day, they still averaged nearly 7 yards a play on offense. So it's not like things were too terrible. It's just everybody was surprised more than anything to see Oklahoma State playing as tough and hanging around. But I still think Florida State, you know, is a team that you have to consider to be the favorite. Jameis Winston's still awesome. That run he put together for that touchdown that was like, you know, he was like, okay, Johnny Manziel's gone, so I'm going to have to start pulling off this kind of crap where I'm spinning and I'm jumping and I'm, you know, juking left and juking right. That was an awesome run. That was one of my favorite moments of the day. But it was a surprising game, but I guess, you know, Oklahoma State might be better than we thought, it early anyway.
So Jameis Winston hit circle, triangle, the juke stick at least once, maybe twice. I was trying to go because it was spin, jump, a couple jukes. It was absolutely a video game run. And since
my favorite thing was the hurdle was of his own teammate.
Yeah.
His lineman was like laying down on the ground. He's like, oh, crap.
Got to get
like,
over.
You see the lineman, like he was trying to get up to go block somebody, and he saw Winston coming to jump, and he like, you know, dropped right down to his stomach right away. He was like, oh, or oh, poop.
He just went stop, drop, and roll right there.
It was like a fire drill, exactly.
Okay, so we're still feeling like Florida State is one of the best teams in the country. Not shaken from that at all. You know, credit to Oklahoma State. Alabama had a performance against West Virginia where I had, again, sort of a similar feeling that I was expecting there to maybe be a few bumps along the way. West Virginia played Alabama pretty tight, but just really left a lot of points on the board, blew a lot of opportunities, it's almost gotten their own way. And then there are just some moments, and DeAndre White had a great catch and run. Amari Cooper had a big game. You know, obviously, when you have Derrick Henry and T.J. Yeldon going over 100 yards, you know, Alabama, in a very Florida State way against Oklahoma State, there were just moments where it showed that the talent level was just about a notch or a notch and a half better. And it's almost like if they can break those one or two plays, the tired storyline is that you need to be perfect to beat Alabama. You don't need to be perfect, but you can't trip over yourself as much as West Virginia did.
Yeah, is there going to be a Lane Kiffin cam in the corner of this podcast?
Oh, we've got to talk about that Lane Kiffin cam. That's out of control. Christ,
that was, yeah. Now, you mentioned those West Virginia drops and shooting itself in the foot. Christian Jones had a pretty big drop in that game, too.
Jeez, yeah. You called it the drop of the century.
Yeah, that was not pretty. But, I mean, I think what stood out to me the most in this game was that Alabama's defense seemed to be having trouble in the secondary particularly. There's some concern there, in my opinion, heading forward into the season. But overall, I mean, it's not like Alabama – they only won by 10 games. But if you look at this box score, Alabama pretty much dominated this game across the board. They had 538 yards of offense and averaged 6.6 yards per play. So – I think this is more of a story of West Virginia just overplaying expectations because we're so used to seeing Alabama destroy these teams, especially early in the season. So it catches you a little bit off guard that way. But I don't really have too many concerns about Alabama after this game, even after only winning by 10. I thought Blake Sims played very well. I mean, he had the interception. He didn't throw a touchdown, but he still completed over 70% of his passes, which if you're playing quarterback for Alabama and you have T.J. Yeldon and Derrick Henry, if you're completing 70% of your passes, things are going to be all right.
Okay, so Auburn and Arkansas, they were locked at 21-21. Then Auburn kind of blew it open. Cameron Artis Payne and Corey Grant had a huge game. Duke Williams, junior college transfer at wide receiver, looks just as nasty as advertised. Watching Auburn and Alabama, do you still sort of see them as equals, as you know, one of these two teams? They are the best teams in that division, and whichever one sort of beats the other in the Iron Bowl or gets enough breaks will end up winning the division?
I think so, and I slightly lean towards Auburn because I feel like once Nick Marshall came back in that game after missing the first half, that was a completely different Auburn team. I mean, the defense kind of had some problems in the first half slowing down the Arkansas run, which, as I mentioned on Twitter during the game, I said, Arkansas's offense is actually starting to look kind of Wisconsin-ish, which it really is. You can see that Bielma's getting in the guys that he's normally had in Wisconsin, and Arkansas starting to head in that direction a little further. So you wonder if Arkansas's further along than I thought before the season, but over the second half, after the delay, which I read the Arkansas coaches got stuck in an elevator during halftime. I don't know how that affected things going into the second half. But yeah, it was a two completely different games before and after that delay. Before the delay, you thought Arkansas had an actual chance. And after the delay, Auburn looked like Auburn and Arkansas looked like Arkansas again.
JT Barrett, reactions to his first start for Ohio State. I think that he's settled in, and I'm probably walking away more surprised that the offense probably met or even exceeded my expectations for Ohio State. Defense had a little bit of trouble. And playing Navy is, I understand, playing Navy.
Playing Navy is a pain in the ass.
Yeah, it's absolutely a pain. It's something that no defensive lineman wants to do it. And, you know, you hear, you know, I'm here in Raleigh, you hear all of the ACC players talk about how much they hate playing Georgia Tech. I mean, it's just like a game that they don't want to be there for, with all the cutting and having to deal with
that. You like
that.
Your knees and you want to keep them.
Yes. I have no I'm not going to argue with a player who says that they don't want to play Georgia Tech or Navy. But weren't you a little disappointed by that defensive line?
I mean, yeah, I guess you could say that. Navy did. They ran for, what, 370 yards, averaged nearly 6 yards a carry. But still, it's, again, normally you would think with as much time to prepare for it as no Ohio State had that it could be better. So it was somewhat of a letdown, but I wouldn't say I'm disappointed. No, it's running, stopping that option. I mean, especially at the defensive line, because what Ohio State's strength is on that defensive line is getting pressure.
Yeah.
And when you're facing an option attack like Navy has, you're more about just trying to fill a gap than anything. So Ohio State's defensive line was kind of taken out of its element a bit playing that kind of offense. So I don't have too much concern about it. No, I think they're still going to be fine. I still think it's one of the best defensive lines in the country, and it'll show that as the year goes on. But I think as a whole, Ohio State, there was a very slow start, which shouldn't have been that unexpected considering, you know, how nervous JT Barrett probably had to be in that situation, because he wasn't expecting to be in this kind of situation until a couple weeks ago. But at the end of the day, Ohio State averaged 7.6 yards per play. So the offense was fine. A couple big plays helped balance that out a little bit, but it was a slow start, and we're seeing that kind of across the country this week. And it's, you know, the first game of the season, there were a lot of good teams off to slow starts who finally got their act together late in the game, and Ohio State was another one of those teams.
Why is there an assumption, and I'm probably just as guilty of it as anybody, that teams are going to be this, like, static plug and play, like this is what this team is going to be, and that teams, you know, can't get better or can't change, or that the fact that a team is going to come out in week one and just because everybody's really excited about them doesn't mean that they're going to be reaching that expectation or that point yet. Like, I'm not trying to go all Saban on you, but yeah, it is kind of a process.
Oh, it's definitely a process. And it's like you look at the preseason, just the way we all look at all this, you know, fans and the media before the games actually start, there's just so much hype about, you know, who's going to be awesome and who's going to suck that it kind of gets stuck in your head that this team is awesome and this team sucks. But in reality, nobody's played a damn game yet. So it's like until they play it, take the field, it's like you have to remind people, these are 18 to 22 year old kids. They're not exactly the most consistent people off the field, let alone on the field. So until they get on and you actually see them start playing, it's really hard to know for sure. But of course, we're all paid to have opinions about what's going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, they ask us to make predictions, so I tell them what I think.
Yeah, and I'm still standing by my Purdue's going to win a national title this year prediction.
Hey, Etling pulled through against Western Michigan.
That's right. They can't row that boat anymore because Etling sunk it.
And speaking of beatable top 10 teams, UCLA. What are we going to do with UCLA? Okay. Our next segment here in just a second, we're going to do reaction over reaction. I'm going to toss some statements at Tom and tell me whether it was a reaction or an overreaction. They're not necessarily all my statements, but certainly conversations that are being had right now. But before we get there, well, like UCLA.
Maybe Jerry's body clock theory was right.
Maybe. I don't know, because it really looks like a lot of the same issues that they've had for the last 2 years, which is, yeah, Brett Hundley is really, really good, but he holds onto the ball a little bit too long. The offensive line isn't that great. And these skill position players are like Jordan James and Paul Perkins. They were averaging like less than 3 yards per carry at one point in the game. Got nothing from the rushing game. And Virginia, who has a talented front seven, looked like a bunch of All-Americans out there, as they were just having Hundley run for his life. UCLA commits 12 penalties, many of them on that offensive line. And this is a team that was a sexy college football playoff pick, and Brett Hundley, and with all this Heisman hype. And while the UCLA defense is awesome, Eric Kendricks had a phenomenal game, Miles Jack had a phenomenal game, They did pretty much everything they could. They scored 3 of the 4 touchdowns for UCLA. Mm-hmm. I'm not feeling good about the Bruins.
It's hard to feel good about the Bruins after watching that game, but if there's any reason to not to get too concerned, it's that the offensive line really, you're right, did not look good, and Hundley had the happy feet going, and he held onto the ball a bit too much, which is understandable considering, you know, how little time he was getting. He was more looking over his shoulder than he was down the field a lot of the day. But if there's any unit you can improve as the season goes along, it's your offensive line. So I wouldn't completely give up hope on UCLA right now, but you're right. After watching that game and needing its defense to pretty much save its ass, I mean, it's a little trepidatious about picking them. You know, I picked them to win the Pac-12, and I'm a little bit, you know, regretting that decision right now. But for all we know, next week they can come out and win, you know, by 55 points and look amazing, because that's kind of how UCLA is sometimes.
And they've got the game against Texas in 2 weeks, which mm-hmm. will be another chance to sort of figure out where they're at.
But yeah, and if you saw Texas's defense last night, which not many people did because I believe the game was on the Longhorn Network, but if you did see it and you thought that Virginia defense looked pretty good against UCLA, that Texas defense might give UCLA a lot of problems.
Texas held North Texas to under 100 total yards for the whole game, right?
Yeah, and North Texas, you know, I'm not going to overhype its ability, but it's not a terrible team.
That was a conference title
contender. Conference champion last year.
Okay, that's what I thought.
They got to the conference title game, but that was a bowl team last year, put it that way, and it got just destroyed.
Yeah, no, that was an impressive defensive performance, and I think that we've said on this podcast before, several times, what are you expecting from Texas? I'm just expecting that defense to play at its talent level.
And it did. It was a mean and angry defense, too. That was what I liked about it.
Oh, snappy. I like it when it's snappy.
It was Michigan State-y.
Oh, that's the best kind of defense.
Yes.
All right, let's go to reaction overreaction. Todd Gurley is the best running back in all of college football.
Right now, it's hard to say any different. I don't think that's an overreaction, and I think if you ask Clemson, they would nod very firmly in agreement. He had 198 yards rushing for 3 touchdowns. He had the 100-yard kickoff return. He also, you know, he caught one ball, but he didn't go anywhere with it. He was just, you know, he was taking a break for Clemson. It was like, I tweeted yesterday, Todd Gurley goes out of bounds just to keep things fair.
Yeah.
He is awesome, and you and me, we always love our good running backs, and I think he's going to be our little fetish this year.
Absolutely. I wrote a little bit about this. I think one thing that is in Gurley's favor is how deep that backfield is. The fact that you can bring
I have a theory that Georgia is like using Herschel Walker as some kind of running back stud, like a horse. They're just breeding running backs for Herschel Walker in like a barn somewhere.
You mean actually a stud?
He's like a horse put out to stud. Herschel Walker hangs around Athens and he, you know, breeds running backs.
Well, Herschel Walker said Todd Gurley could be even better than Walker was.
That's really nice of him to say. I am not quite believing that just yet.
But, okay, well, how about this? Georgia. John Solomon, in his sort of big recap piece, wrote that this could be a special season for Georgia, and I agree because coming into the season, again, what do we know? But coming into the season, the SEC East appears noticeably weaker than the SEC West, and South Carolina, which was thought to be Georgia's main competition, is really in tatters right now, at least defensively. Got no push up front. You know, South Carolina looks totally beatable. Georgia does have some cross-division games that'll be a little bit tough, but I like this Georgia team because they were doing some things that were – it's like it's not a very sexy team. Like, obviously, watching Todd Gurley just at maul defenders is pretty awesome. But, like, they were, like, getting good field position. They were flipping the field with their punter. They were like an LSU 2010-2011 type team.
Well, I mean, if we're just going off of what we saw in this opening week so far, and you look at the rest of Georgia's schedule, it looks like a mighty easy for the SEC anyway schedule, because they've got South Carolina next, which, as you mentioned, looks very beatable against after that Texas A&M game. And they get Tennessee, who we haven't seen yet, but you'd still have to consider Georgia to be the favorite at home against Tennessee. They get Vanderbilt, who, yeah,
lost
good luck
Temple.
With that. Uh-huh. Missouri, who struggled against an FCS team for most of that game until they finally got their act together in the fourth quarter. A road game against Arkansas, which is still Arkansas. Florida at home, or in Jacksonville anyway, on a neutral site. You get a road game against Kentucky. Then there's the Auburn game, which is really, if they get past South Carolina, I mean, I have a hard time seeing Georgia losing any of its SEC games until that Auburn game. And that Auburn game will be in Athens. So, yeah. I think you could definitely buy this, as this could be a very good season in the making for the Bulldogs. But then again, if Georgia loses South Carolina in 2 weeks, will anybody really be that surprised?
No. All right, this is the two things that jumped out at me, because I knew that they were going to be good running the ball. I did not sort of take into consideration some really good special teams play and a defense that I haven't gone back to review to watch it a second time. But whatever corrections they made
at halftime
worked.
Yeah, it worked.
They came out and they pitched a second half shutout. They were forcing a ton of three and outs, and they just took Clemson completely out of its game, because Chad Morris's Clemson offense was kind of humming there for a little bit in the first half, and they just completely squeezed them out and really forced Clemson's hand to try and start playing catch up. And when they had to start playing catch up, they started getting three and outs, and that's when they just started giving the ball to Nick Chubb, giving the ball to Sony Michel, just giving the ball to Gurley, and just grinding out the game. And I could see that being a trend for Georgia sort of throughout the season.
Yeah, I mean, I do believe that'll be the plan. It's going to be, they're going to use that stable of running backs they have to just slowly and methodically wear out opposing defenses, so that way once the fourth quarter comes around, they're just going to run them over.
Okay, South Carolina, it will not be able to reach 10 wins this season. Reaction or overreaction?
I'm leaning overreaction right now.
All right, why not?
It was a terrible game. South Carolina looked terrible against North Carolina to open the season last year, too. You know what I mean?
And then they went on to win 11 games.
Yeah, all the talk was about Jadeveon Clowney taking plays off, and he looked terrible, and he looked out of shape, and then they went on to kill everybody or most people for the rest of the year. And again, South Carolina, a lot like Georgia in that SEC East, gets somewhat of a favorable schedule the rest of the way. But they've got Georgia, they've got Missouri at home. They've got to face Auburn on the road and Florida on the road and tough, and Clemson on the road are tough. But South Carolina never really seems to have too much trouble with Clemson. Florida is, we don't know what Florida is going to be yet, but this is still a team. Look, I could see them going, 9-1 to finish this one out. I don't think it's going to happen, but I don't think it's impossible.
Well, the other side of that Thursday game is Texas A&M and Kenny Hill. And Kenny Trill or Kenny Thrill.
Just call him Kenny Hill?
Anything but Kenny Football.
I think the worst thing that Johnny Manziel will, his worst part of his legacy as a college football player will be the fact that we feel like we have to give everybody a stupid nickname.
Tom Football. Hey, Tom Football.
Tom for Football, actually.
Oh, all right. What's your readjustment on Texas A&M?
It's funny because everybody's been talking about Kenny Hill since that game, and rightfully so. The kid threw for 511 yards, but what stood out to me more than anything was that defense. Because that's going in. The one thing I've been talking about Texas A&M the entire time before the season started was that defense was terrible. And until that defense improves, Texas A&M is not going to improve. And South Carolina averaged 7 yards per play, which isn't good. But they also had a couple of huge gains from problems in the secondary and miscommunication between young two. They had two freshman safeties.
Texas A&M. Armani Watts, one of those safeties, played pretty well.
Yeah, he did, but there was still some miscommunication and coverage issues. Now, I'm not writing that off. The secondary still definitely needs work, but what stood out to me was the front seven, which was god-awful last year, looked much better in this game against South Carolina. They were penetrating. They weren't getting blown off the ball. They weren't having, they weren't having huge holes opened up. They had 3 sacks against South Carolina, which Texas A&M did not have a lot of sacks last year. That was one of the biggest problems. So when I see that front seven, that's my biggest reason to think that Texas A&M could, have a bit of a bounce back and could be a competitor in the SEC West. If Kenny Hill keeps playing as well as he has, as well as Kevin Sumlin quarterbacks normally do, and that front seven continues to get better, as long as that secondary starts to get its head out of its butt a little more often, this is a team that can be really good.
It is. I am concerned about the Aggies defense for the reason that South Carolina picked up a lot of chunk plays. Like, while Texas A&M...
they have to work on the explosion plays. Yeah, but Texas A&M, as everything was, else, they looked pretty good.
Texas A&M was methodical. You know, they were, like, slowly, like, marching down the field, very, very efficient. South Carolina just hit a bunch of big plays to be able to get their points. I think that Texas A&M, I give them a slight upgrade defensively because the defense finally can kind of match the offense, which is... if Kenny Hill and Speedy Noyle and Ricky Seals-Jones and Malcolm Kennedy, if they can get down, score points, and force the other team's hand, which is really what happened to South Carolina. I know Mike Davis, and we very, very concerned about Mike Davis's ribs, but South Carolina really had to stop running the ball because they were going to need to score points quickly. And when Texas A&M is able to force your hand like that, that's when you've got freshman defensive end Miles Garrett, who's obviously going to be learning as the season goes on. But man, if his only job is to go get to the quarterback, he is a problem. And they've got other players on that defensive front. And they like you said, they were bringing some pressure. They were getting to Dylan Thompson. And that's like the perfect counterpart to Kevin Sumlin's offense, is a D with a couple of really good pass rushers, because they know that you're going to have to be trying to move the ball quickly, and that's when they can really find some success.
Yeah, I mean, Texas A&M is not going to need to have a shutdown defense to win games. They're just going to have to need, you know, kind of a bend but don't break kind of defense and get some pressure. And yeah, it's exactly right. I mean, they're going to score 35 points a game. So as long as they're only giving up 21 and they're limiting those huge explosion plays, Aggies will be fine.
Okay, this is a reaction over reaction. Everett Golson's return completely masks the loss of DeVaris Daniels.
It did for one day.
But what do you think going forward?
No. It was
Rice.
I loved watching it, but yeah, it was Rice. And Rice won Conference USA last year, but it's still Rice. And Golson looked amazing. I wrote yesterday, the difference from last year to this year with Golson back is, even without guys like DeVaris Daniels on that offense, for the first time, Notre Dame's offense looked dangerous. Because it did not look dangerous at all last year with Tommy Rees under center. It's not a knock on Rees. It's just Rees can't do the things that Golson can. Golson, his mobility in the pocket, he was keeping plays alive, giving the receivers time to ditch, you know, the defense and get open deep. And then he was just unleashing these bombs that were perfectly placed, and one of them was a touchdown that hit the receiver in the hands and he just flat dropped it. So, you know, Golson lost a touchdown in that game, and you look at his stats and they're still pretty impressive. So I think in the long run, you'd rather have DeVaris Daniels, because the way Golson played, if you give him a weapon like Daniels, that's really good. But I also think if Golson continues to play like he did yesterday, Notre Dame, I don't think it's going to win 10 games, but it's still going to be an 8-9 win team.
All right. Okay. Reaction or overreaction? Wisconsin lost the game. LSU didn't. Like, Wisconsin basically handed the game to LSU.
Underreaction. I you know, that was such a typical LSU game. They were trailing, what, by 20, the 17 points, fake punt, boom, roll off 21 straight, win the game.
Yep.
And
We've seen that movie before.
Yeah, they didn't really get great play from the quarterback, but Wisconsin just... Gary Anderson says that there was nothing wrong with Melvin Gordon. And I hope he's lying. Because if Melvin Gordon was completely healthy and you chose to give him the ball three times in the second half...
Three!
Then I don't know that you have any clue what the hell you're doing.
With the lead!
Yeah. I'm hoping that Melvin Gordon, there's maybe just got a little hamstring issue or something, and they just don't want to publicize it. Because that is just flat stupid if that's the case. Or, you know, I mean, did Melvin Gordon, like, cheat on a test at halftime? And did he get in trouble somehow? What else could it be
Tanner,
that makes sense to you?
Tanner McAvoy, 8 completions and 24 attempts for 50 yards. That's 2.1 yards per attempt, 2 interceptions.
But that's you kind of understand that that's a possibility when you're starting a kid for the first time against LSU.
I mean, I was just saying it as a, like, what was the rest of the offensive plan when Melvin Gordon has 16 carries for 140 yards? Why are you putting it in anybody else's hand?
I don't know. That's why I refuse to believe Gary Anderson when he says that Melvin Gordon wasn't hurt, because Gary Anderson is too good of a coach. We've seen it, you know, from his time at Utah State and at Wisconsin, to think that he's just decided, hey, you know what? I don't really need this guy. I'm just going to put it in my fresh, you know, redshirt freshman quarterback's hands and let him air it out. He'll be able to handle it just fine.
Hey, prop.
There had to be more to that.
Props to Wisconsin's defense.
Yeah, it definitely showed up to the party a little better than I thought it was going to be. But at the same time, LSU didn't exactly ignite the world on fire on offense either. It's like I said, I think we understand clearer now why it took LSU so long to name a starting quarterback.
Yeah, because there's not...
Because Les Miles was hoping somebody would walk on and maybe be awesome or something. I don't know.
Yeah, the Anthony Jennings stat line is mostly boosted by the athleticism of Doral.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
He took off down the sideline, and Anthony Jennings basically had almost half of his total yards on that one play.
Yeah, he threw for... He had the 239 total, and it was 80 yards on that touchdown.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So a third of his total on one play, and he only completed 9 of his 20. That's the thing. The two, McAvoy and Jennings combined last night, Chip, 17 for 45 for 289 yards.
That was on my, that was sitting maybe number 2 in my queue at that point. I had FSU Oklahoma State on 1. And I was watching you, which, by the way, I'm sorry I didn't include USC and Fresno State. That was really impressive. I wouldn't say that I'm like, I've changed my thoughts on USC at all. But if you're talking about a way to change the story pretty quickly from Josh Shaw and from Anthony Brown and get things focused on the field, Juju Smith. As good as advertised. Adoree Jackson, as good as advertised. Buck Allen gets out there, gets loose. The defense looked pretty good. I mean, injuries could derail this very, very thin USC team, but damn, they look nasty.
It is amazing what can happen to talent when you put it in the right kind of system that can actually utilize it.
And what'd they do? They ran...
They ran 105 plays last night. 105 USC, old pro style, you know, fullback and running back I formation. They ran 105 plays and averaged 6.7 yards a pop. They had 701 yards of offense, 37 first downs.
They're
11 of 18 on third down, 3 of 5 on fourth down. They went for it on fourth down 5 times. And they won by, you know, 39 points.
I like this team.
I was enjoying the hell out of watching this one. I mean, it was never close, but I was having a good time.
I'm crushing on the Trojans a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, Cody Kessler finished, you know, 25 of 37, 394 yards, 4 touchdowns, averaged 10.6 yards per attempt, not completion, per attempt.
Okay, one last, we'll stay in the Pac-12, one last reaction, overreaction. Totally bailing on Washington as a great team, as a potentially good
fire
team.
Fire Chris Peterson.
After watching them narrowly escape Hawaii 17-16.
Yeah, fire Chris Peterson, bring back Stark. Funny things can happen to teams when they have to travel across most of the Pacific Ocean to get to Hawaii and play a game. You spend a few days in Honolulu and your starting quarterback is suspended. But, taking all that into account, that was an ugly, ugly game. I mean, Washington finished with 336 yards of offense, but it's important to remember that 91 of those came on one play in the second quarter for a touchdown. So you take that out that one play, and Washington really had 241 yards of offense against Hawaii.
Boise State's offense did not look good, did not look great last year, and was not great against Ole Miss. And Washington this year on offense looked like it desperately missed Steve Sarkisian, Bishop Sankey, and Keith Price. And I think drawing too many like connections around there, for some reason, I just in my head figured that Washington's offense was still going to be that like productive upper half of the conference, pretty good, but not like good enough to beat you without some good play on defense. And it was, I mean, I'm selling my Washington stock pretty fast. I mean,
I'm not completely selling it, but yeah, I certainly don't blame anybody like you who would want to.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go just sort of bounce around conference to conference. Anything that jumped out at you? I'll start by throwing this. Ole Miss can only, and this is, again, I just think Ole Miss is only going to be able to go as far as Bo Wallace. Those interception, three first half interceptions were no bueno. And with Texas A&M clearly trajectory looking up, I don't know if Ole Miss is the definitively fourth best team in the SEC West right now.
That's when you have Bo Wallace, that's always the caveat with this team. There's just so much talent, but no matter how much talent you have on offense or defense, if Bo Wallace is out there doing stupid things, it's going to hurt you. And Bo Wallace was doing a lot of stupid things in the first three quarters of that game against Boise.
What anything else from around the SEC jump out at you?
I would say the highlight of the weekend for the SEC was actually, if you saw the segment on game day, Dan Mullen responding to a tweet about being called, you know, Cousin Eddie from Christmas Vacation. And I can't say what he said here, or I can if you promise to bleep it out.
I mean, take a note. Yeah. What 35 minute mark? Go ahead. Go for it.
He read a tweet from, you know, a fan that said he looked like Cousin Eddie from National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. Then he just looked up at the camera and said, "Merry Christmas, s***er's full."
Nice. There you go, Dan Mullen.
And yeah, Dan Mullen went flying up my coaching power rankings for that, and he probably should be the coach of the year. Then they won 49-0.
Your boy Tevin Coleman had a pretty big day as Indiana decided they were just going to hand him the rock all day.
But that was so strange to me because Indiana, we think of that offense, and you look at the day that Tevin Coleman had where he finished with what?
247
yards, okay? But how the heck does Indiana only score 28 points against Indiana State?
Oh, I know.
They had 566 yards of offense. They were 11 of 17 on third down. How the hell did they only finish with four touchdowns in that game?
Dude, I don't know. I looked at that box score, and it was weird.
And I'm asking honestly because, I mean, I didn't watch it. I'm just looking at the box score. But it's like I don't know how an Indiana offense that, you know, would score 50-something against good Big Ten teams last year was only able to manage 28 points against, you know, Indiana State.
What else jumped out at you from across the Big Ten?
The Big Ten West is wide open, and it's incredibly – it might be more wide open than I thought before. I think Wisconsin, if we're basing it off one game, has to be the favorite in that division now because everybody in that division looked really bad or just plain bad at times. I mean, Minnesota struggled with Eastern Illinois before finally putting them away. Illinois had a really hard time with Youngstown State for three quarters before West Lutton blew up in the fourth and put them away. Iowa beat Northern Iowa by 8 points. I mentioned Indiana only managing 28 against – or they're in the East. Never mind. Sorry. Purdue won,
barely,
which is awesome for Purdue, but they still struggled with Western Michigan, which is a team that was just as terrible as they were last year. And Northwestern was down 31-7 at home to Cal, which went 1-11 last year, and then staged a pointless comeback to lose 31-24. So besides Wisconsin, which had its own bad ending, nobody in the West looked very good, and it's going to be a strange division.
Is that a very Northwestern thing to do to all of a
sudden? I'm sorry, I forgot Nebraska. Nebraska looked great, but they were playing FAU, so you can't take anything too serious.
I told you they were going to roll them.
They got Carl Pelini. They got revenge for Carl.
I mean, they didn't stop.
No, it was like Carl Pelini at a party. They just didn't know when to stop.
498 rushing yards, 770 total yards. 779 offensive yards, 498 of them on the ground, 232 from Ameer Abdullah.
Pretty decent.
Pretty decent. ACC, UNC doesn't look like a top 25 team. That's for sure.
No.
they combined, UNC and Liberty combined for 10 turnovers. The two quarterback system doesn't really work. They had a 3-minute and 58-second period where they had four straight touchdowns. But outside of that, not a very impressive performance for Larry Fedora's bunch. Virginia Tech got some good play from their freshman running backs. Anything jump out at you?
Syracuse is bad.
Oh, yeah.
Very bad.
Terrell Hunt getting ejected for throwing a punch.
Yeah, that was a fun moment. But even that team did not look good at all against Villanova. NC State, my bold prediction was that NC State was going to finish third in their division. And then NC State beat Georgia Southern 24-23 and needed 21 points in the second half to even do just that. And I'm like, that was a big mistake, Tom.
Let's see. Tyler Murphy, do you remember him from Florida?
Never heard of him.
Really?
Yes, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, he had like 100 yards rushing in the first half. Seems like Adazio is just going to have him be Andre Williams and just have him carry the ball 40 times a game.
Yeah, so I guess he'll never have to catch a pass then. He just has to.
Yeah, he'll throw it to himself because I don't think they have they're not strong at wide receiver. I know they've still got, I think, Swigert and a few other guys. In the Big 12, we already talked about Oklahoma State. We already talked about West Virginia. Oklahoma, a game that was only on pay-per-view in the Midwest.
It's 2014,
Southwest.
And Oklahoma, a team that's ranked fourth in the country, is playing another FBS team, and the game is on pay-per-view.
I didn't get to see any of it.
What is with the Big 12's TV deal, Chip?
I don't know. That was bad. I'll tell you what stood out to me just from looking at the stories and reading some of the writing and looking at the box score was that Keith Ford apparently is going to be the guy. I've sort of been watching that running back competition for a couple months, just sort of curious to see who emerges from there. But you know, this is still a Trevor Knight will take it as far as they can go, and I don't know outside of Shepard who the other wide receivers are. And when Doriel Green Beckham was announced that his waiver was denied by the NCAA, that was sort of the thing to me is Blake Bell going to become this awesome receiving threat? Are they going to need to just start throwing to guys out of the backfield? And I think Keith Ford, in addition to being their leading rusher, was one of their leading receivers as well. So I'll be interested, really, really interested to watch Oklahoma once they're no longer on pay-per-view to see how this offense is going.
Once they're no longer $49.95 a game.
Yeah. Sorry, bro. Ain't paying that.
Yeah, no, I don't know how much it was. But no, as far as the Blake Bell becoming a receiving threat, considering he didn't have any catches yesterday, I would say the odds of that aren't good.
Aren't high.
No, yeah, I didn't see any of it either. All I have is the box score to go off of. But you're right. I mean, it's still a team to me that it's going to be go as far as Trevor Knight's willing to take them. But as far as the rest of the Big 12, I mean, I also saw Cliff Kingsbury celebrate that new contract extension by just barely beating Central Arkansas. And then there's Iowa State, who...
What'd you say? This is your joke, but hey, that contract's dry, right? Like, it's been notarized and everything?
Yeah, the ink on all that right, sucker's cool. Dry, right? They can't wipe your name off yet, because that is not the way you want to go out and celebrate your new contract extension. I mean, imagine if they lost that game.
Oh, man.
Oh, boy. And then speaking of teams losing games that they... Well, actually, Iowa State losing... It's funny. North Dakota State beating Iowa State by 20 points is not an upset to me in the slightest.
No.
I mean, there's a reason that was only a 3-point spread. And it was because conventional wisdom says you should give the home team 3 points. I think if Vegas was putting that line together just based simply off the two teams, North Dakota State would have been favored in that game. And they showed why, as North Dakota State gets an FBS opponent for its fifth straight season.
Trevone Boykin ends up winning that TCU job, and the 48 points that the Horned Frogs put up were more than any game from 2013. Looks like the change in offensive coordinator. I know that the opponent was one thing.
Samford.
But still.
Samford and still,
the fact that they appear to have that straightened out. Kansas State still just did some work. Texas Tech, like you were just saying, Davis Webb, 2 first half interceptions, 15 penalties total for the Red Raiders. That's no bueno.
No, I'd say having 15 penalties is seldom a good thing. And that was the situation, too, I think, in the Iowa-Northern Iowa game. Iowa beat Northern Iowa by 8 points, while Northern Iowa had around 15 penalties, and Iowa didn't have a single one. And they still only managed to win that game by 8 points.
I'm super excited about Royce Freeman, Oregon's running back, and just sort of all three of those running backs in the Pac-12. During the broadcast, they were talking about how with the absence of a lot of like proven wide receivers, the offensive staff is actually really excited about the pass catching ability of all these guys. As Marcus Mariota and Oregon. I mean, a top five team, a national title contender. As that proceeds forward in the next couple weeks, I'll be really interested about that starting next week when they host Michigan State. So that'll be fun. Connor,
yeah, you know, Oregon, to me, these stats that we always hear from Oregon's early season games just feel like empty calories to me.
That's totally fair.
Yeah, the Ducks always do this against everybody. It's like, oh my God, they're just – but yeah, it's South Dakota. So, I mean, Oregon's going to be awesome. I'm not saying that, and there is plenty of reason to be excited. You know, Royce Freeman looked good. Thomas Tyner, Byron Marshall all had big games. Mariota had a big game. But I can't take anything Oregon does seriously until next week when they play Michigan State.
But that's – I mean, I'm excited that we at least will have that game now to be able to get a good idea of what's going to happen before they dive into the meat of that Pac-12 schedule.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I mean, it's, I don't know, man. I can't get pumped until Oregon until I see that Michigan State game.
Fair enough.
I just can't.
Sort of off the board, cleaning things up. Christian Hackenberg props was school single game school record, right?
Yeah, you know, but Penn State did not look very good in that game.
Okay, tell me more about that one. You were on that from the beginning. I was sort of in and out, running some errands.
The defense looked
downtown.
Really good for the most part. I mean, UCF only had 246 yards of offense in that game, which was good. But just Penn State, it's like Hackenberg put up a good line. He put up 454 yards, but he had the one touchdown and the two interceptions. And it just is. It was kind of Oregon-ish. Like a lot of those 454 yards, it's like I don't remember where they came from, to be honest. And then it was just Penn State. Coaching-wise, James Franklin, I think, had a bad start. There was just some questionable decisions. They had one third and goal where they sent Hackenberg out to play wide receiver and did like a direct snap to Zach Swinak. So it just was like a memo to UCF. They don't have to play the pass on this play. So UCF stuffs them on third and goal. They have to get a field goal out of it. Then at the end of the game, after they finally lose the lead to UCF, they've got three full timeouts. They get a first down, and I think it was their own 45. Okay, and there's like 57 seconds left or something. And instead of using one of their timeouts, they just let it go. They take their time getting to the line. They get one play, get another first down up to the UCF 41. It's like a 15-yard gain. And at this point, there's now only 17 seconds left in the game. It literally took them 42 seconds to run one play when they had three timeouts. And at no point did Penn State ever say, you know, maybe we should call one of our timeouts.
You know, it was a big day when James Franklin, one of the, you know, buzzworthy coaches in all the sport, and Penn State, one of the most like storied programs, when James Franklin's coaching debut is kind of embarrassing, and yet
nobody's
talking about it.
Yeah, and I mean, I felt good for Sam Ficken, because if you think a few years ago when all this stuff originally went down after Paterno was gone in that first game, Ficken came and he missed those field goals, and you know, Penn State lost at home to Ohio. And it was just, he was the GOAT. I felt good for him to be able to kick a game winner like that for, you know, the start of this new Franklin era. But overall, I mean, Christian Hackenberg is good. And I think Penn State's going to be good this year. And I think Franklin's going to have a lot of success at State College. It's just that first game, I was scratching my head a lot watching that one.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. All right, what are you looking forward to the most in the next couple days outside of reconvening on Wednesday for the next Expert Picks podcast?
I look forward to Baylor tonight, Sunday night, as we record this, against, you know, opening that new stadium, because I feel like they're going to want to put on a show, and I think it'll be a blowout early, but I'm going to have fun watching it anyway.
That's going to get me back in the game with these confidence picks.
Yeah, actually, you know what? I hope SMU covers. And then I think the Utah State-Tennessee game tonight could be pretty interesting, too. And, I mean, in an upset kind of way. But other than that, I'm looking forward to, you know, it's been great having all these games the last few days and having more games still to go. But I'm honestly looking forward to a bit of a break Tuesday, because we put in an 18-hour work day on Saturday, and that's tiring.
It's a lot.
That's you know, no more games in Ireland starting at 7:30 Central Time, please.
Yeah, no thanks.
It's too much for Tom. Way too much for me.
Well, I appreciate you taking some extra hours out of your Sunday so that we can knock this out for all the good people, all these loyal listeners, the Ion College Football Podcast.
I do it for you, loyal listener.
He is Tom Fornelli. You can follow him on Twitter at Tom Fornelli. I'm Chip Patterson. You can follow me at Chip_Patterson. Please remember to subscribe to the Ion College Football Podcast. If you subscribe, then as soon as that thing is posted, you'll be able to get it first. Then it hits CBSSports.com on the blog.
Hot normally, off the digital presses.
Normally a few hours later. For Tom Fornelli, I'm Chip Patterson. Thanks so much for listening.